Blog Talk Radio.
Philadelphia. Good afternoon, sir. Mr. Waters? Okay, he may not be able to hear me at this point. We'll go on. I do know that we have Mr. Phil Walker. Mr. Phil Walker, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well, Dr. Bride. Happy holidays to both you and your listening audience.
Thank you. I appreciate you. And so you have a very interesting project going on with the Redemption Project. I've been doing some research about it, excited to have the opportunity to discuss it with you today. So what I thought I would start off with, actually, has to do with something that let me start off with you, Mr. Walker. You have an initiative going on that is very, very intriguing to the whole criminal justice process. I understand it's like a three-tier. You actually start in the elementary schools helping young people, students, to become real comfortable with the idea of interacting with law enforcement so that they're not fearful and so they don't see law enforcement as a threat. Then you also work with juveniles in our detention centers. And then you have an exciting program in the prisons, even taking a look at the foods they eat. Can you share a little bit about the Redemption Project, please?
Absolutely, Dr. Bryant. And again, thanks for having me on the show this afternoon. I'm going to try to take a very long history of what we've been doing over the past 2 to 3 years and summarize it in a succinct fashion. You started off by talking about the recidivism rate. My partner and I, about 2 years ago, Dr. Bryant, began taking a look at the recidivism rates at the state prison facilities around the country, and specifically in Pennsylvania. And on average, you mentioned over 35%. On average, it's about 47 to 48% of the inmates that come out of a state correctional facility recidivate or go back in within 3 years. And so as we began doing our research and our due diligence about the reasons why, and then developing a platform and a program about how we could potentially address that, it became abundantly clear to us that for many of our young people who move from elementary school, junior high, high school, detention centers, and into correctional facilities, our schools became a gateway, increasingly became a gateway to the criminal justice system. And so we felt, based on the due diligence and the research that we've seen, that the school-to-prison pipeline, that we couldn't just address this at the state correctional facility level. We had to really go back and begin to address this at the K-8 level. And so we felt that it started in the classroom, or it's best avoided in the classroom. And so, you know, as we kind of gathered the information, we were able to see that, you know, 1.2 million young people drop out of high school annually, which for the most part, we all know, creates a cycle of poverty and unemployment and violence. And what's interesting is those young people, that 1.2 million, well, students from two groups, for the most part, racial minorities and children with disabilities, are disproportionately represented in that pipeline. And so
right.
You know, we talk about that children with disabilities, those are always young people who are diagnosed with all the acronyms, right? You know, the ADHD and the dyslexia, et cetera. And many times they're misdiagnosed or they're stigmatized only because they may learn differently. And so they're cast into this light with these other groups. And so they make up this school-to-prison pipeline. So with all that as a backdrop, as we began taking a look at all of this data, and then the data also said to us that by incarcerating these young people at a huge cost, that reduce their educational attainment and the probability of incarceration as an adult. If you incarcerated them as a teenager, there was a much higher probability. So with all of that as, you know, kind of the backdrop on this, and then all of the other what I'll call intrinsic sort of maladies that come with removing young people, teenagers, and then adults out of our community, removing them from families, from their neighborhoods, leaving their children, their partners, their neighbors, to kind of bear the greater sort of economic burden and social challenge. It's devastating for our families and devastating for our community. It's been devastating for our community. So, and again, and it's hit folks of color or those traditionally underserved much harder, and that's left us to kind of bear the brunt. So with all of that, we created about 2 years ago an organization and a program called the Redemption Project. And we're based in Shalfont, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of Philadelphia. And it's an evidence-based program. It's an evidence-based program. And our mission is to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, Dr. Bryant. And so it's a multidimensional organization. As you mentioned, there's a three-tiered approach. The first level for us is with the K-8 students. And keep in mind, my partner and I come from an entrepreneurial and corporate background. And so one of the things that we said early on is that we have to partner with and bring in under our umbrella those that have the educational and programming platform and structure that we can address these issues that we're seeing at both the K-8 levels, at the juvenile detention or high school levels, and then ultimately within state correctional facilities. And so that's what we did. We partnered with and brought it under our umbrella, two programs that have been around for a while that have evidence-based data and that were already working within state correctional facilities and within the juvenile detention centers, and we brought them under our umbrella. And the first one is something we call Character Be About It. And so that's a program that really teaches character development. And so it allows our young people to kind of model, if you will, these 13 character traits of grit and determination and persistence and attitude, et cetera, et cetera. But what's interesting and really dynamic about this program is that it uses state troopers. The individual who created this program, who is now our vice president of sales, Matt Harris, when he created it, he developed a model where state troopers, law enforcement, actually teach the courses to these students in K-8. And so it teaches them the essential character traits that I mentioned a little earlier. But more importantly, as you had mentioned, Dr. Bryant, it cultivates a positive relationship with law enforcement. I don't have to tell anybody either on the line or in your listening audience what we've seen over the last 5, 7, 10 years in terms of misunderstandings and the things that can come as a result of fear on one or both sides when law enforcement encounters our young people. And we've seen too many of these situations occur, which has resulted in death and things that probably could have been avoided. And so it helps our young people to develop that relationship with law enforcement, overcome the fear. It also gives law enforcement to get a better understanding of the culture and background of our young people. And so we're really excited about the program. We've partnered with Penn State University, who does all of the metrics and the analytics for us in the program. We've been able to show, in terms of the evidential data, that these students that go through this program, that they show not only better relationships with law enforcement, but also improved test scores after participation in this program. So we're really excited about it. Yeah, really excited about it. And then we also
about the juvenile.
Absolutely. So just moving from the K-8 to what I'll call the juvenile detention centers, again, we brought a program under our umbrella called aggression replacement training. And this is one that really takes a look at, and again, specifically for juvenile detention centers, it focuses on keeping these juveniles, these young adults, out of the system upon release. And so we really look at anger control, moral reasoning, conflict resolution, some skills streaming, as we call it. And so at the end of the day, we focus on that as a way to help them to really better manage their behavior as they're coming out of these facilities so that they don't go back and do the same things that got them got them there in the first place. The second part of that program, above and beyond what we call ART, Aggression Replacement Training, is our Counselor's Advantage for Success. And that's really a mentoring program. So we actually have a mentoring program upon release that are these students, these young adults, are engaged in, and it offers them information around post-secondary education, with financial, you know, where do you go if you want to go to college? Where do you want to go if you want to go to gather information about college or technical school and things of that nature? And again, evidential data, Dr. Bryant, that shows that individuals that go through this program have shown a clear reduction in violent incidents, both inside and then we track outside the facility as well.
Absolutely.
And then the third I'll try to bring this to an end, but our third level is really focused on the state correctional facilities. And we've seen, as we were doing our due diligence and our research, we saw that there were a number of vocational training programs that were out there. And so we've done the same things. We've developed a vocational training program around culinary and green landscaping, green cleaning. And then we're training these inmates on these programs. We have a mentoring program inside. But here's the kicker for us. Our background, both personal background for myself and my partner, is that we understand. I'm a former professional athlete, by the way. And so I understand, and then my partner also understands, because he owned 14 vegan restaurants around the world. We understand the relationship between a nutritional diet and behavior and healthcare outcomes. So that was clear to us. And so as we kind of said, okay, how do we help these inmates above and beyond providing them with career opportunities, help them to better manage their behavior and also healthcare outcomes while they're in the prison, as well as when they leave the prison? What can we help them with from an educational standpoint, so they know what not to put in their body, so they know what kinds of adverse effects that sugar and some of these other ingredients might have on them in terms of their behavior? So we have something we're calling the Redemption Research Project, which is essentially it's offering a integrated program, which includes a plant-based diet that really examines the physical and psychological effect that this diet will have on behavior and healthcare outcomes. And so we're really excited about it. We've met with the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania. They've given us the go ahead. We're now in the what we'll call fundraising mode for the project, and we're really excited about it. We think that can have some significant effect, and again, not just with the cost to deliver healthcare services to these inmates while they're there, not just to reduce violent behavior and violent incidents while they're there in the facility, but once they leave, arming them not only with the information of, again, what to put in their body, but we also have a culinary class and nutrition class that they take, so they understand what the foods are and then how to cook the foods. And so when they leave the facility, we want them to understand these are some of the foods I can't individually go near, because it will have an adverse effect on me and could affect my behavior. And so it's really exciting, and there's data that's already out there that suggests that it does have a significant positive impact on both behavior and healthcare outcomes. So, again, that's kind of the overall mantra for our program. We've seen in Pennsylvania that most of these facilities, state prison facilities, they're operating at 115% of inmate capacity. So, the population is growing faster than the general population, and so we felt that a multi-level approach was the best way for us to approach this problem, both short-term and long-term.
Absolutely, and it's quite innovative, to say the least. Thank you for that overview, and we're going to be engaging in more conversation about the benefits of what you're doing a little bit later in the show. So Judge DeLeon, I wanted to make sure I say that correctly. You
either way is good.
An awesome. I'm sorry.
I said either way is good.
Okay, either way, good.
Either pronunciation, yes, either
both.
Pronunciation.
Okay.
It depends
but
on what part of the country
about...
I'm in. You know, different parts of the country pronounce my name different ways. So.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
I say everything's okay as long as you're calling me in time for dinner.
Okay, right? I was raised in the North. I live in the South. So I may say anything, okay? but I want you to talk about Operation Fresh Start. I often am a proponent of utilizing particularly the expungement process, and you define it a little bit differently. Can you talk about Operation Fresh Start and how you're defining pardon and expungement and some of the successes that you've seen?
Sure. Well, it's a book that I wrote called Operation Fresh Start that has the concepts and the means on how to produce those concepts into reality that
okay.
I published. Okay. So basically, it does take into certain things that Brother Walker touched on, specifically mentoring. Mentoring is a big part, but rather than use state troopers, we use the formerly incarcerated. With the or not that they had to be incarcerated, but they can also have been formally on probation, that as a means
right.
of becoming back into society by becoming mentors for a period of time with emancipated youth, that would lead at the end of their mentorship to a governor's pardon or in specific instances. Expungements, depending on what the type of crime is, and we're not talking about crimes like rape or murder. We're talking about like you know a robbery F2. Basically, if a person snatches a handbook, and that was 10 years ago, and now the person is 28 years old and he's been living a very good life. You know, married with children, but he still has that stigma, that S that's over his forehead. Basically, what we have to understand is that crime, in particular violent crime, is a complex phenomenon that exists in any big city, and reducing it requires a variety of approaches touching a range of factors. No matter what ideologies may say, there is no one magic cure for violence.
Absolutely.
Now, men and women newly released from prison are an important group to reach. And paying attention to them as they reenter society is one of the prongs of an effective crime-fighting strategy, like you just opened up your program on. Low-quality education is linked to high dropout rates, which produce jobless young men who commit crimes and go to prison, where they are not rehabilitated but are hardened and become more likely to commit further crimes. So there is very little successful effort to rehabilitate nonviolent offenders, meaning some of them eventually will become violent. And we treat everybody the same, and we need a new model. Now, in Pennsylvania, we have more than 50,000 state prisoners, and that's up 484% since 1980.
Wow.
Yeah, and we have a soaring recidivism rate. And Pennsylvania is constantly building new prisons at $250 million a pop. Somebody's at my front door. Can you hold on a second, doctor? You have to excuse me for a second. I don't know why.
So, Mr. Walker, while we're waiting on him to come back, do you work with the courts at all in any of your initiatives, or strictly other than the juvenile detention center? Do you work with the courts at all?
Dr. Bryant, we have not begun working with the courts as of yet. Our focus has really been with the detention centers, the state correctional facilities, as well as the
schools
at this juncture.
Okay.
Yeah, but there are a number of other stakeholders, including the court system and other what I'll call nonprofit agencies, and i.e. Organizations like Judge DeLeon has explained, that we will be working with, and we've already begun reaching out to many of them in the Pennsylvania area. Absolutely.
Let's collaborate. A neighbor, one of my neighbors, came over to drop off a Merry Christmas gift. I mean, it was really nice of him, but it was unexpected. But let me go back. Like I was saying, you're exactly correct, Brother Walker. But like the money that we're using on these prisons, like that $250 million, you know, that we're putting using to put up the prison, that money would be better spent on community and rehabilitative programs for nonviolent offenders, thus creating space for violent criminals who need to be imprisoned. Now, the reality is, like you were saying, as the stakeholders, the reality is that the community, the governmental entities, and the formerly incarcerated must partake in what I call a shared responsibility format.
Absolutely.
Now, under the doctrine of the shared responsibility concept in general, to fight recidivism and augment reintegration, the community, its leaders, both elected, appointed, and recognized, the jobs and school sectors, and the fallen citizen all partake in a manner consistent with their duties to the community, where all do their part to make the fallen citizen totally reintegrated into their society, either without the stigma of a conviction, or that the previous fallen citizen and the community understand that even though the conviction is one that cannot be erased, the citizen is forgiven by the community with reintegration after completion of a shared responsibility approach program. Now,
I love it.
In every state, that approach has to be embraced and started from the top. The governor of the state to the mayors of our cities for credence and success to build off of. Specifically, as Brother Walker said, as to the mentorship program that they're running for the emancipated youth, it starts, in my book, I start with the governor's mentorship initiative, which is an ideal vehicle with which to start the doctrine of shared responsibility, and its success will sensitize communities throughout the state to the benefit of other shared responsibility programs, such as I have one that's called an execution type one, that where a person comes into Operation Fresh Start through judicial admittance. And then there's a type two community admission, where a person would come into Operation Fresh Start through the through a community program, and that the participants who complete either the governor's mentorship initiative, either the judicial admittance, or either the community admittance would have their records pardoned and expunged. See, the whole thing is about pardon and expungement. You got to give people hope, because the reality is in a city like Philadelphia, we have over 179,000 people that are walking around with criminal records, okay? And these are people that have walked off their pardons. They've walked off their paroles, but they're walking around basically with little hope of ever being made whole again. And this does impact their families, okay? You know, like the reason why, if you listen, like Brother Walker, he had to, his programs are actually taking over the position of families, what families should be showing for these children. So, you know, that right there is showing that there's such a lack of hope that the individual child's family cannot fill that void, and you have to have outside individuals, outside organizations fill that void to try to save that child. Okay.
So let me interrupt you here. We got to pay some bills. So can I interrupt you for a moment, Joe?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay, no problem. I love talking to people who are excited and passionate about this topic. It's my it's a topic that's near and dear to me too. But let's hear a word from our sponsors. Bryant Educational Seminars and Training, delivering the very best in training design and dynamics. Motivational, educational, informative, inspirational, relevant, and knowledgeable, nationally and internationally. These are the words that seminar participants have been using to describe this dynamic presenter. From topics as non-threatening as customer service to topics as delicate as race relations, diversity, and inclusion, Dr. Maxine Bryant has repeatedly captured the hearts and minds of many audiences. She's a very able orator who is well-versed in a variety of topics and has presented and or developed workshops, lectures, and keynote addresses to diverse audiences across America, in the Grill, Jamaica, West Indies, Cairo, Egypt, and Ghana, Africa. She has provided workshops and training seminars for companies, organizations, such as Thompson Consumer Electronics of RCA, the Salvation Army, the City of Indianapolis, the National Council of Negro Women, Planned Parenthood, Michigan Public Health Institute, and many, many others. Every seminar and workshop is custom-made for the audience. Dr. Bryan's expertise has assisted private industry and nonprofit businesses to forward move to realize their desired goals. Call Pat Malt at 612-876-7964 to book Dr. Bryan to take your workforce to the next level. Now back to our show. Gentlemen, you all are awesome. I do want to ask you if and we just had a caller. Let me pause for a moment. Okay, so never mind. I got that now. But so, gentlemen, I want to get back to you. Michelle Alexander wrote a book, and I know you all are familiar, both of you are familiar with that, The New Jim Crow. And in it, she talks about, in Chapter 5, she talks about the absence of particularly African-American men from the families. And for a lot of time, for many years, we were talking about the absentee father. And what Michelle brings out in this chapter is where they are. It's not that they just disappeared. It's not that they're lazy or not wanting to take care of family. It is that they're incarcerated, right? And if you are incarcerated, and the system is not doing anything to begin to bridge families or fill in that void, then we enter into a cycle, not only of recidivism, but a cycle of generational incarceration, if you will, because there's that brokenness in the family. So just let me start with you. In your court, have you seen evidence of this generational cycle of parent and child and grandchild coming through your courts because of that broken family?
No, of course. Not only have I seen it, I mean, I've been a judge for 30 years, but before that I was an attorney for 10. So I represented a lot of families, and then I represented their children. So, that's a definite. That's one of the reasons why I've written this book. That's why I'm trying to stop that cycle. That's what everything in my book is geared towards stopping that cycle of regenerative families. Always, you know, that it's like the fathers. I know people right now who the father is in jail for homicide and the son is in jail for homicide, and they're both in the same jails, 10 to 12 years apart. Being put there, I'm totally familiar with that, and that's why I wrote the book. That's why I was just appointed as of this past Friday to here in Philadelphia, the city council, Councilman Curtis Jones here in Philadelphia, a great man. He has he chairs a committee called the Special Committee on Criminal Justice Reform. And he just appointed me on this committee as of last Thursday, and I just received notice yesterday that my appointment letter is in the mail. It'll be coming shortly. So we're trying to focus on aspects that, again, will relieve recidivism and augment the reintegration of returning citizens into our society. And the book,
so I want to interrupt you there because you use very important words. I differentiate reentry from reintegration. Reentry puts the onus and the responsibility on the released prisoner, on the person with the criminal history. It says, for example, in Georgia, we're going to give you $25 and a bus ticket home, and you're on your own. Reintegration, as you've noted, involves the total community, the employer, the landlord, the family, the lady down the street, the mentor, And I had a program in Indianapolis that I called Neighborhood Network that trained people in the community as well as people with criminal histories who had already been out 3 to 5 years to work closely with newly released individuals to help them become full citizens. So I love what you're doing there, because the community has a responsibility to help people in their own reintegration. We can't, I think I read somewhere where you wrote, if the community, if the person fails, and I know I'm not going to get it right because I don't have it with me in front of me, but you tie very neatly the fact that the community has to have a vital role in helping people to become whole. So let me ask you this. For many people who come out of prison, they're faced with what we call collateral consequences. What can we do about that?
See, the whole thing is you have to be able to give the person some hope that he's going to be reintegrated. You can't just have a person come out and basically he's just like there. You know, he, like you said, with the $300 in your pocket and a bus ticket, and you just, you have to be able to have something set up where that person can, where he can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Let's say it like that. Because depending on the crime, everything is always depending on the crime, but all crimes are not unforgiven. Okay, and unforgiven doesn't mean that when you pay your debt to society by being incarcerated, that that you will always be paying your debt, because you will always have that crime on your record, and no matter what you do, you can't get it erased. I mean, there are governor's pardons. You know, every state has governor's pardons. Like in Pennsylvania, the governor, I talked with our lieutenant governor 3 years ago and gave him the concepts for Operation Fresh Start, and he came out with a program at the beginning of 2017 called Pathways to Pardons, where we are running through the state senators. The state senators have pardon petitions. They give workshops, and the people, they fill out the pardon petition from the state senator, and the pardon petition says the name of the state senator on it. And when it goes down to the Board of Pardons and Parole, that person, it's looked upon more favorably. You know, it gets like a fast-track kind of system, because the thing is that we have to expand pardons, and it has to be politically accepted. See, the problem is that pardons aren't politically accepted per se. So a governor might only give 80 pardons a year or to 150 pardons a year, when every year you have you might have 1,000 people putting in for pardons, and you have like 19,000 people coming out of prison each year. So you know, so every year you always have these 19,000 people coming out, but you're only doing like 80 pardons. So you're not doing anything that's going to alleviate you're not reintegrating enough people back into our societies.
Right. Let me see if caller from area code 248 may be our third guest. Judge Waters, is that you? Area code 248, you're on the line. Okay, well, we will continue. Let me pause, Judge Dion. I want to go back to Mr. Phil Walker, because, Mr. Walker, when I think about your program, you're involved in prevention as well as intervention, and to a degree aftercare. And what Judge Dion's program really focuses on is reducing recidivism through aftercare, through addressing total reintegration of that individual. So what we do know, Mr. Walker, is that there is a direct correlation between education and incarceration. What I tell people here in Georgia is that it's no mistake that our educational system in Georgia has long been had a history of being subpar. But yet Georgia incarcerates more people than California, New York, you know, places like that. We incarcerate. incarcerate more, right? We are one of the leading states, traditionally have been, as it relates to incarceration. When you look at your prevention in the elementary schools and then even with your juvenile centers, and then you educate with the whole adult, with the adults in the prison system, are states and entities or government entities, I think that's what I'm trying to say, do they see the importance of the total package, or are you having to explain how each tier fits in with the overall goal of reduced recidivism?
Sure. A couple things. First of all, from your lips to God's ears in terms of understanding the relationship between a poor educational system and an influx of community members and individuals going into the prison system. There's no question there's a direct correlation there. I want to come back to that in just a second. Because you were talking a little earlier about Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and it brings something up in my spirit around, you know, if you go back 25, 30 years, you know, this whole disproportionate sentencing, right? You had three strikes and you're out, right? And that took a whole number of both men and women, mostly obviously men, off of the street, as well as other sentencing disparities that we've seen, whether it's crack cocaine versus white powder, and the list goes on and on. Judge DeLeon, I'm sure, knows this story all too well. And so there's a disproportionate sentencing paradigm that we've had over the last 20 to 25 years that has taken fathers and mothers, in some instances, off the street, away from their families, and then you've had that generational sort of curse that's taken place from when the father's not in the home, mother's not in the home, they don't have that parental support, the mentoring that they need, all of a sudden the children are falling into that same trap. And so as I listen to today these commercials about the opioid epidemic, and they don't talk about, and look, at the end of the day, I want everyone who has that kind of an issue or malady or challenge to get support, to get treatment. But you never heard them talk about treatment 20 or 25 years ago. They talked about locking them up. They talked about just say no. Now today, what they're talking about and what they're stressing is, you know, because of prescriptive drugs that's now leading to other things, it is now about treatment. So it's pretty interesting, and I think we all understand and know this, but I just wanted to point that out because I think it's necessary that we understand where this thing has come from in terms of the criminal justice system and all aspects of it and kind of where we are today. But back to your question very quickly. You mentioned Georgia. Philadelphia is similar. I mean, Judge DeLeon just threw out some numbers in terms of the number of people that are incarcerated or are coming out of the correctional facilities and correctional system in any given year. Well, again, that's directly correlated and related to the school system for, in many instances, Philadelphia. If you take a look at how our school system ranks against the top 20 cities around the country, we are historically around 19 or 20. If you take a look at the top 20 cities, major cities in this country, Philadelphia was number 20 last year in terms of being one of the poorest per capita cities there. And there's a correlation between education, lack thereof, and economic opportunity, and therefore being able to make more money and not have to resort to other things. So we all know that. Everybody on this phone knows that. And I think many of your listening audience knows that. The challenge has always been, how do you connect the dots? And how do you make sure that from a legal perspective, from a programming perspective, we have the support system that helps to support these folks before they go in. So let me talk about, to your question, the prevention piece, and then I'll talk a little bit about the intervention and then the aftercare. The prevention piece for us, it goes back to you asking whether or not do other stakeholders recognize the relationship between the prevention piece and what happens on the back end, whether or not
right.
you have to invest in the K through eight and the kind of programming that we're doing now can help keep someone out of jail or out of the correctional facility and correctional system down the road. The answer to that is, yeah, we don't necessarily run into a lot of challenge around the K through eight because, you know, part of what we talk about is not just the relationship between law enforcement and these young adults or at this point these young kids, but also building the character piece and also anti-bullying. That's also a part of what we train around at that K through eight age as well. Where we sometimes run into some of the challenges are really in the juvenile justice centers or that area, because that's where, you know, keep in mind, that's where we're really focusing in on anti-violent behavior. And I say that from the anti-violent behavior and really the conflict resolution, things of that nature, really fostering, if you will, those behaviors that will help prevent you from going back in to the facility. So anger control, things of that nature. It's a little bit, even though our data, evidential mm-hmm. data, shows that we can have a reduction in violent incidents, and we track this. We work with the University of Cincinnati and Penn State that is kind of acts as our research partners in tracking a lot of this information. Sometimes because it's the data there doesn't necessarily always correlate, even though we're talking about a reduction in violent incidents, it doesn't always correlate over to giving someone a warm and fuzzy feeling that this person, when they
right.
come out, is not going
right.
to knock somebody in the head or not going to rob someone. And so there's
yeah.
always, and you know, when you're talking about K through eight, they're young people. You can mold them. I mean, you can make some. You can make a huge impact on them. And so the funders, if you will, and I'm really talking about this from a funding perspective, they have a tendency to want to get engaged there. A little bit more difficult when you start talking about the juvenile justice center and some of those elements there. So on the prevention side, we do a lot certainly around some of the what I call aggression reduction training and character building and mentoring. You know, Judge DeLeon talked about this a little earlier, and he talked about the city council and Curtis Jones and these individuals. Certainly the mentoring piece for whether it's, you know, these inmates or just young people in general, because many of them are coming from single family homes or coming from situations where there may not be a responsible parent in the home. And so therefore, in many instances, as we've seen over the decades, the street is raising them. Mentoring programs have a tremendous impact on the behavior, the character,
yes.
the direction
mm-hmm.
that these young people take. And so it's clear to me, based on the conversation we're having here, is that programs like Judge DeLeon's program, my program, and all the other programs out there that are attacking this major issue, this multi-layered issue, all of us are in partnership in some way, shape, or form, and can't
right.
help but have the need to work together to try to address some of these major issues.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a question to think about. We're going to take a break. But I want to talk next about the documentary, The 13th, talking about the 13th Amendment. Have you both seen that? It's a Netflix documentary.
I haven't seen it, but I can talk
okay.
about it.
Okay. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Now a word from our sponsor. Have you ever been frozen in fear? Stuck on stupid, literally lost in love, tormented with troubling relationships, felt disconnected, discombobulated, and dismissed? Has parenting ever felt more like a burden than a blessing? Have you questioned your own sanity, doubted your own self-worth, wish you were someone else somewhere else? you often feel that you're not good enough, not pretty enough, not smart enough, not talented enough, unworthy, unlovable, and undeserving, then you know what it feels like to be out of your groove. And the groove doctor, Maxine Bryan, has just the right prescription. Get your copy of her book, I Want My Groove Back, God's Way, to begin your journey towards living in real groove. This inspirational Bible-based book is insightful, concise, and an easy read. Go to www.mygrooveback.com in order to order your copy today. $10 plus shipping cost. You will be glad that you did. Back to our show. So, you all, let me tell you a little bit about the 13th. It's a documentary. Ava DuVernay produced this, and it takes a look at a clause in the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery except for in cases. I'm sorry?
No, I said emancipation. Yes.
Right. Right. Except for when a person had been convicted of a crime. At that point, the whole term of slavery then gets real slippery, because according to some how some people interpret the 13th Amendment, anyone who's been convicted of a crime then can be enslaved, because the whole notion of slavery and emancipation fit only those people, or pertain to only those people who were not convicted of a crime, right? And so there's been a lot of discussion around the 13th Amendment and how that ties directly into mass incarceration generally and mass incarceration of African Americans specifically. Do either of you have any thoughts around that?
The prison farms.
Yes.
It's the whole. It led to prison farms. Specifically, the South would make the prison farms where they took prisoners, like black prisoners, to build roads. So they weren't really learning a skill that would translate into work once they had completed their sentence. They were basically just manual labor and it's still being used like that specifically. But now it's in the North and even in the South now, it's become now where a lot of people are skilled in making like beds, chairs, tables, things of this nature that are utilized by the state governments. I was just over at city council the other day, and I was sitting at a desk that had just been made by inmates. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, this type of thing. But if I could say that, what leads me, I was listening to what Brother Walker, well, what you said about the 300. This all goes into what you said when you said in Georgia, how a person gets $300 and a ticket home. When that person, well, that's even worse. Okay. And well, when that person
and,
gets
and,
off,
and Judge DeLeon, that sounds a lot like 40 acres and a mule to me. But
I
that's
wish
okay.
Everybody, look, we've been pushing for that 40 acres and a mule. You know, we've been pushing for that. That would solve all our problems.
Okay.
You know, but the prison programs, what's happening is that Pennsylvania Department of Corrections report in 2013 found that 6 in 10 released inmates were rearrested or reconvicted within 3 years, and the vast majority of repeat offenses occurring during the first year out. So what that shows is that with all the training and educational opportunities that exist for inmates, those opportunities don't necessarily equate into outside the wall permanent employment. So the
mm-hmm.
prison programs, as I see it, they need to be retooled to allow for innovative programs that would make the prison, I hate to say it, but you got to be able to make the prison a more attractive source for employers, thereby making the returning citizen a sought after employable person. Now, I had three aspects. I can just touch on them real fast. Was the German Workforce Skills Initiative. Now, under that, the primary goal of that initiative is to utilize and align Pennsylvania's existing prison educational opportunities and workforce development resources to create a system of dual-track training that mixes equal parts education and work, with the object being to develop the best training program possible to meet the needs of Pennsylvania businesses for highly skilled workers best suited to business needs. Now, Pennsylvania companies, government, prison, and education institutions would partner together to begin preparing identified inmate students for the workforce through apprenticeship-style models of education. And the training and the work facilities would either be on or off the prison grounds. Now, there's just one other, well, two others, and I'll go through them real quick if I can, Doctor.
Real quick.
The second, okay, the second of those is the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Initiative. Now, you're familiar with Goldman Sachs and their 10,000 Small Business Initiative that they're doing across the country.
Right.
And with that program, okay, it would, the program phase, though, would be a teach-identified inmates proposal writing, with the objective being that the inmate would be able to identify, either through government sources or the inmate's own research, viable business opportunities, and write a detailed program proposal that would be acceptable to a government agency and or investment or lending source, all under the guidance of Goldman Sachs. That those identified inmates would also complete the 10,000 small business curriculum, in which they would gain the skills needed to recognize new opportunities, embrace practices that increase business growth, and ultimately develop a customized growth plan for their business. And that inmate would be in a work study followed by work release setting, in which in both
okay.
they receive a real salary commensurate with their training being received and or the job being performed. Now, they could have a sliding scale rent that would be deducted from that, but they would be able to support their families, okay?
Right.
You know, which is what we want. We want them to be able to support their families because we want the families to see that they're trying to be better people. Now, the last thing I just want to say is that, you know, you can't leave the victim out. You can't leave the victim out.
Okay.
Now, we have a thing here in Pennsylvania called the Crime Victims Compensation Fund, where people that have been the victims of crime, they can petition for the payment of money from the Crime Victims Compensation Fund that would go to them because of the fact that they were a victim. Now, one thing we can do with that, we can also augment that with a scholarship program. So under that program, the crime victim would have the opportunity to attend and complete either the Workforce Skills Initiative program or the Goldman Sachs Small Business Program at the prison under a full scholarship provided by and through the Crime Victims Compensation Fund.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Innovative.
So these are things, you know, we can't forget about the victim, but we also have to be able to, you know, because the victims, it's also been shown that victims end up becoming perpetrators. So, you know,
right.
So we're trying to break the cycle, you know. We're trying to break the cycle.
So now let me ask both of you this. As it relates to collateral consequences, those invisible, often silent restraints on released prisoners, the people but the laws that say individuals with criminal histories cannot vote. Or, for example, here in Georgia, in Savannah specifically, we have crime-free zones where landlords and apartment complexes are encouraged not to rent to people with felons. You have, obviously, the inability to get food stamps or apply for student loans if you have drug charges. What can be done? What are some suggestions that you have for those type of things that prohibit or get in the way of a person becoming a whole citizen?
Well, we have to remember that, Brother Walker, you want to say it first? Or You want?
Yeah, let me. Well, let me talk a little bit about the corporations, just in terms of the what you're calling, Dr. Bryant, the stigma attached to these inmates as they're being released. More and more corporations, because Judge Leon brought up a great point. At the end of the day, we can take them through all of the training, all of the character development exercising, et cetera, but when they walk out of that facility, they have to be empowered and armed with skills and the appropriate skills to be able to go out there in the work environment to not just get a job, but to create a career for themselves and just be able to support their families. And so one of the things that we do through our program is on the front end is identify employers who have I won't call it a knack, but don't have an issue with hiring inmates that have been trained and with the necessary skills. Now, I will tell you that list is growing, but there are still a number of major corporations and mid-sized companies that just will not touch an inmate. And again, depending on the industry, you know, if they're in the financial industry where you have to come in contact with money and you know, all kinds of things of that nature. But I will tell you that that noose, if you will, is loosening. And so you have more and more companies that are beginning to take a look at pools of talent. And pools of talent include those that are recently incarcerated. It includes veterans. Mm-hmm. It includes urban young adults. It includes physically challenged. And so they're looking at non-traditional pools of talent to be able to source to fill many of these high-tech jobs. And I think we've all heard over the last 3, 4, 5 years that over the next 10 to 12 years, the number of tech jobs that purportedly are going to go unfilled, right, because they can't find the right people. They can't find enough people. Well, yeah, you can. You just have to be open enough to be able to go past the traditional – 4-year degree and other sort of requirements that have always been in place about hiring many of the folks that are coming out of incarceration. So I think on the corporation side, we're starting to see a little bit loosening, a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more liberalism, if you will, around hiring inmates. And again, depends on what kind of record they come with, et cetera, but hiring inmates. As a matter of fact, there are a number of organizations in Philadelphia right now, manufacturing organizations, and that are hiring inmates and become a source that we've talked to as a source, if you will, on the back end for these young people. But I want to go back very quickly because and I'll make this very quick because you were talking about some of the programming that's out there. I think Judge DeLeon was talking about some of the programming, training programming that's out there that is kind of innovative, but more importantly, it is tied directly and aligned directly with the jobs that are going to be created over the next 5 to 10 years. So you talk about Goldman Sachs, which I'm very familiar with. It's a great program. There's an interesting program that started by a hedge fund guy out in California. It's called The Last Mile. And essentially it's for this program is in right now. It's in six state correctional facilities in California. And it's a program for inmates where they are teaching them software development skills. So they're creating apps, right? They have already come out and been hired by Google, Microsoft, organizations like that that are looking for those kinds of skilled workers. And so what you're starting to see branch out, because the privatization of incarceration has been around for a while. Think about the fact that Obama, within President Obama in the last 3-4 years, actually stopped the proliferation of these privately held companies opening up new federal facilities. The current president has come in and overturned that since he's been in office. So now you have these privately held companies that are back in the business of incarceration, and they're not training these inmates, not training those that are inside with the necessary skills so that they can function on the outside. They are training them on skill sets that they can build a mini business so they can sell, they can create revenue for their company and for that state correctional facility that they've partnered with. So it, there's some disingenuous sort of things that are happening, but at the same time, certainly on the back end, I think corporations are starting to become a little bit more open around hiring many of these inmates.
And one of the things that's helping them is something called transitional jobs. I focused my dissertation on transitional jobs, and that's where the pay for the work is subsidized through government programs or private industry or what have you, so that their salaries are paid for a period of time, usually 30, 60, 90 days, while the employer gets a chance to work with them, get used to having a person with a criminal history on the premises, and we make sure they're bonded and all of that. But there's the Safer Foundation in Chicago, the Center for Employment Opportunities called CEO out of New York, are such programs that are called transitional jobs, where individuals who are coming out of our prison system get a chance, an opportunity to learn a skill, work for an employer, have their salaries paid for a period of time with the hope that the employer would then reach a level of being comfortable with bringing them on full-time with benefits and salary and everything that that their other employees would make. So hopefully that type of thinking can help employers to feel more comfortable with hiring released prisoners.
Yeah, Dr. Brown, we're very familiar with
That person saying that, at the end, mm-hmm. being able to have his record pardoned would be,
yes,
a total win.
Absolutely.
That's what the whole thing is about. You know, when these people go to these jobs and they do good jobs, that
right,
they should be in line to be able to get those governor pardons, you know, and get those records expunged. But the
absolutely
one thing I just wanted, what I wanted to just like remind you is that most civil disabilities attended upon a federal felony or state felony, such as loss of right to vote or hold public office, that they're imposed by states and rather than federal law, and they can be removed by state action. So,
right.
Yeah, what you were saying, that all goes to sensitizing our, especially our people, you know, who were,
yeah,
elected, you know, that were elected to look, they're specifically supposed to be looking at this, what these, you know, which ones should be removed. There shouldn't be anything where, you know, where you can't vote because you were convicted of a crime. You know,
right,
once you've done your sentence, you know, you should be able to vote. And in Pennsylvania,
right,
now, Brother Walker, you can vote. Can you vote now from jail? You can't vote from jail in Pennsylvania yet, right?
That is correct. You cannot.
Yeah, but once you get out, though, you're able to vote.
I'm not sure. I think there is a period of time. I'm not sure if you can register right away and have the ability to vote in the next election. I'm not sure what that policy looks like, quite frankly.
Yeah, it might not be the next. It'll be the following election after you're released. Yeah.
And it does vary from state to state. In Indiana, people who are in jail can vote. But if you're in prison, you cannot vote until after you're released. But the minute you're released, you can vote. In Georgia, you cannot vote immediately after being released. You have to appeal for that, and you have to wait until you're totally off paper. Now, there are two states in the United States where people can vote in prison. That's Maine and Vermont. So convicted felons serving in a state prison in Maine and Vermont can vote while they are incarcerated. Now, that's just those two states. That doesn't happen everywhere. So clearly it would be great if we could have some consistency across the board, because voting, in my mind, is very pivotal to me feeling like I'm a citizen. I'm a part of society. My voice matters. And to say I can't vote because I have a record, and that record I may have done something when I was 18 or 19, did my time, learned my lesson. I participated in programs like the Redemption Project, and I'm ready, you know, to be a contributing member of society, and yet tell me I can't vote or I can't live in certain places, or if I fall on hard times, I need to apply for food stamps, but I have a drug charge, I can't do those things. So, you know, we create in our society we help to perpetuate that cycle and create a situation that makes it very difficult for people to fully reintegrate back into society. Judge, I want to go back to something you were talking about, but first, and it's about restorative justice, but first, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Tune in to www.blogtalkradio.com, Gumbo for the Soul, every other Monday at 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time to listen to lively conversations that are relevant, dynamic, and inspiring on the Dr. Maxim Bryant Show. The first 30 minutes of this hour-long show is called Groove Talk and is dedicated to uplifting listeners and engaging them in life-changing conversations that can help them move forward with their weekly tasks. Each show highlights an Athens book, I Want My Groove Back, God's Way, as she and her guests explore groove stealers and groove imitators. The last 30 minutes is called When Is My Debt Paid? And focuses on challenges and successes of released prisoners as they reintegrate into society. The next show is Tuesday, December 26th, and she will be honoring Umoja, the first day of Kwanzaa, with special guest Lillian Grant Baptiste, who will discuss finances as groove imitators and how living Kwanzaa principles can keep this tendency in check. The second segment, When Is My Debt Paid?, focuses on people with criminal histories and how integrating Kwanzaa principles into their lives will aid in their community reintegration. Call 347-539-5285 to comment or ask questions during the show. So, Judge, let's talk about restorative justice. You mentioned that, you didn't call it that, but that's basically honoring the victim and having there to be some healing between the victim, and if it's not a known victim, it's society who has been victimized, and helping the newly released individual to, one, take accountability for what he or she has done and make amends. So it removes the stigma, we talked about that, and it helps the person, in my mind, to better themselves and to be more successful in their own reintegrative efforts. In some restorative justice models, the victim or victim's family will meet together with the perpetrator and begin dialogue with a mediator. It's a very structured type of endeavor to create healing. Is that utilized at all in Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania, rather?
It depends on the circumstance, per se. That's one of the things that we want to look at. Now, you know, it's hard sometimes we have the victim's impact statement, where once a person has been convicted of a crime, then the victim has the opportunity to speak to that person and tell that person what they did to them, what it caused to them, how they feel about that, and the victim can use that as a time to tell the person that they forgive them. The convicted individual can tell the person that they're sorry. We have that kind of situation, but now generally those are on crimes where people have gotten kind of like hurt, you know, through either like a rape or aggravated assault of, you know, some kind of assault, attempt to kill, you know, things like that, where people have been like paralyzed. Those are kind of like they're very hard. There's a lot of emotion on those. It depends on – a lot of people don't want to think about it anymore. You know, on an attempted rape, they don't want to see that person anymore. They don't want to think about it. It's hard for – but it does happen. It's just not the rule. It's an exception for it to be done outside the court. Let's say through a church, you know, some sort of program like that. Brother Walker, have you seen much of that?
No, I haven't. I'm not able to talk intelligently about that subject.
Okay.
Yeah, that's so it's hard. It's hard. That's why I came up with the Crime Victims Compensation Scholarship Fund. Specifically, to address the victim, to let them know they're not forgotten, because a lot of times you forget about the victim in trying to help the incarcerated individual, the person that's on probation. You're trying to give that person, you know. So I didn't want to leave the victim out. I want the victim to be able to be able to better themselves as well. If, you know, through the same system, you know, let's better both. Let's better everybody. Let everybody have the opportunity to succeed in life.
Okay. So let me ask you all this question. In 2015, I think it was, I was invited by a organization called the Transatlantic Roundtable on Race and Religion to speak in Ghana. And the theme often is the role of the Black church as it relates to different issues in our community. And I'm getting ready to take a really close look at the role of the Black church as it relates to the criminal justice system and specifically to individuals returning to our communities from prison. Do either of you have any thoughts on the faith community? So not just Christianity, but the faith community as it relates to having a role to help people to successfully reintegrate back into society?
Dr. Bryant, absolutely. The faith-based community has a strong role. I mean, if you think about the African-American community, should I just say the Black community, not just African-Americans in America, but the Black community in general, our core has traditionally been through the faith-based community. So we've grown in terms of education. When you wanted to hear about what was going on in the community, both politically, civically, the church or the mosque was the centerpiece and the place you went to gather that kind of information and to get that kind of data. At the end of the day, the faith-based community has a strong role in, you were talking about reentry and reintegration. Certainly, they can help around the reintegration piece, because I mean, if I think about what I believe the Muslim community has done extremely well, the Muslim community has gone into, not waited until the inmates came out of prison, but they've gone into the prisons and basically delivered a number of programming concepts and educational activities, so that when those individuals come out, and they've talked not only to their head, but they've also talked to their heart, and that's a different topic.
Right.
But they've helped them to understand that when they come out, they should have already made the decision about which way their life wants to, which they want their life
to
go, but they also need to be trained in specific skills. So you have a number of faith-based organizations that are providing that kind of program.
Yeah.
And many of them are Muslim-based, but there's also some Christian organizations as well. I think there needs to be a concerted effort, and I'll say this on the Christian side, in terms of some of our churches stepping up and being more public, more vocal about how we can support our inmates, or these recently released inmates, as they're coming out, and to do that, and actually to have programming at their churches, because a lot of the churches now, you're seeing them, they got these tech educational programs that are now taking fold, and they've got a number of other vocational training programs that now have under their umbrella. Well, keep in mind, you know, you were talking a little earlier about some of these corporations being able to take advantage of these transitional workforce sort of credits and things of that nature. That's exactly what the churches can be taking advantage of, along with these corporations, because we look at when these inmates come out, they go on the, and we're very familiar with the transitional programming. When they come out, they go on these 90-day, 120-day interviews. That's really what they are. They're internships, but they're interviews. So interviews, okay, meaning they get an opportunity to spend 90 to 120 days with a corporation, or it could be with another stakeholder or entity, to show their wares, show what they've learned, show their character, show their skills. And so it becomes an interview for that 3 or 4 month period, and the corporation at the end of that makes a decision on whether or not they want to keep them. But the churches have a significant role, and the mosques as well, have a significant role in helping to facilitate the learning, the reintegration of these inmates back into society from a holistic perspective.
Yeah.
Because this thing, coming back into society, is not just about getting a job or a career,
right,
even though that's a very important part of it. It's about family. It's about reconnecting,
yeah,
with, you know, and really, you know, you were talking about, I think Judge DeLeon was saying a little earlier about making sure that the inmate takes responsibility, and there's a victim responsibility, but the inmate takes responsibility. They've got to come to grips with, hey, I made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And that mistake allowed me in that situation to fail, but I'm not a failure.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I now pick up the pieces from where I am? Could be I'm displaced from my family, I'm displaced from society, I'm walking back into a situation where I now may have some skills and I'm better prepared to deal with the same challenges, because the challenges haven't gone away, right?
Right.
So I'm better prepared
right.
to deal with those same challenges and have a better outcome and make better decisions about how I move forward. Faith-based organizations can help significantly around
Absolutely.
Some of those decisions.
And you
yeah.
know what? You bring up the point when you talk about the Muslims. I'm Christian, but when I go into churches and I talk to them, I let them know that for years, particularly in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, the Muslim community could, with valid statistics, boast about having a lower recidivism rate for people who converted to Orthodox Muslim while they were incarcerated, because of the level of support that they got while they were incarcerated and that continued post incarceration. And Christianity does not do that the way that the Muslim community does, but we can. It can be done. We've just not done that as effectively. So I'm glad you brought up that point. Judge, you were going to say something?
Yeah, basically I was going to let you know that in my book, I touch on something called the Lifers Public Safety Initiative, the PSI, which uses
okay.
the Malcolm X paradigm and the use of
yes.
cognitive information to bring at-risk
okay.
youth to a position of initiating dialogue, reflecting on behavior, and actively participating in the public safety initiative to achieve community and the unexplored potential they possess, and they are encouraged to take those principles back to their peers. Now, what the Lifers want is to establish these PSI transformation centers at churches and mosques to offer a spiritual conversation, which when combined with the PSI, can bring about cognitive transformation, which together will work to help end the culture of crime. Now, they feel that the transformation centers would have key among their volunteers, PSI members who were once part of the crime culture, who, through being role models, their transformation into positive, productive, and law-abiding members of society would provide leadership for young participants to follow.
Okay. Okay. Now, Doug,
okay. So that's all. That's through the mosque and the Christian churches.
Okay. Can you tell us how we can get a copy of your book, sir?
Diane can get you a copy. She has them digital, so she can just forward you a copy digitally.
Okay. What about anyone in our listening audience? How can they get a copy?
Well, if I had their addresses, I could mail them a copy. Otherwise, Diane, she has them digitally. I don't have that. You know, I'm not an IT person, but I know that she does have them. I mean, she does have them digitally, where she can definitely give them so that your audience can digitally receive copies.
Awesome. We're going to have that information available. Let's take a pause for a final word from our sponsor. And when we come back, we're going to have closing comments from our speakers, our guests. You're listening to Incarcerated Lives Matter 2. I am Dr. Maxine Bryant, your host. Need a speaker for your next event, conference, or church service? Dr. Maxine Bryant may be available to come share her wealth of knowledge and experience on multiple topics. A licensed minister, Dr. Bryant draws on God-given communication talents and gifts and combines proven instructional design techniques and an award-winning presentation style to inspire and instruct, to educate and enlighten, to plan, promote, and problem solve, and to embrace participants and an exhilarating experience. Call Pat Malt at 612-876-7964 to find out how you can arrange for Dr. Bryant to come to your next event. Gentlemen, it has been a pleasure talking with you for the past hour and a half. We've been talking to the Honorable James N. M. DeLeon. DeLeon. And Mr. Phil Walker. So, as we prepare to close out, I'd like to start with Honorable James M. DeLeon. And what closing words do you have to say to our listening audience?
Basically, that it's been my pleasure to be with you on this show, Doctor. You have a very informative program. Your guests are very enlightened. The subject matter is extremely relevant, and it just needs to be accomplished. The goal of successful reintegration of returning citizens into our society.
Yes. Thank you, sir. Mr. Phil Walker?
So, Dr. Bryant, again, thank you for allowing us to have this very substantive and what I think is relevant discussion around the criminal justice system and specifically reducing recidivism. I think over the past 90 minutes, I think it's been abundantly clear to me and I think to both of you, and I suspect to a large part of your listening audience, that the challenge around reducing recidivism is multidimensional. I mean, and so it's clear that there needs to be partnerships between many of the stakeholders to help to address this issue and address this problem, because at the end of the day, it has been and will continue to be the communities of color, the families within those communities, and that are going to be significantly challenged and, again, bear the brunt, if you will, of the prison boom that's taken place and will continue to take place. So I'm encouraged by the conversation that we've been having. I do want to just make a quick little plug here, if I can. We are in the process of the Redemption Project of we have a crowdfunding campaign going on. We are raising funds to support and our schools. We have roughly right now about 104 school K-8 schools that want our program in there, and so we have a crowdfunding campaign where ambassadors can adopt a school and help pay for the services are being delivered at the school. So I would ask your listening audience if they have an interest and an inkling to do so, to support our young adults and to support our young people, go to www.theredemption-project.com, www.theredemption-project.com, and you'll be directed to a link there for giving for our crowdfunding campaign. But it has been a pleasure, and I'll see you guys on the battlefield.
Awesome,
yes.
Awesome. And it is a collaborative effort. It's going to take all of us. I like something that the judge said, and it's that this project, the Operation Fresh Start, is not the only answer, and that it does indeed take all of us working together from all spectrums to be able to put a dent in this our national problem of mass incarceration and over-incarceration. You've been listening to Incarcerated Lives Matter. What we talk about is not necessarily a pretty topic, but it is a necessary topic. Our nation is as good as our prisons are, and our prisoners need to come back to a place where they can help to be made whole. Thank you very much. I'm Dr. Maxine Bryant, your host for Incarcerated Lives Matter, 2, produced by Ms. Beverly Black and Ms. Diane Sears. See you at our next Incarcerated Lives Matter 2 on January the 27th. Saturday, January the 27th, will be the next show for Incarcerated Matters Lives 2. Thank you very much.
Just like a bird, I just want to fly free.
So high.
And I own a piece of land somewhere off in a country. Oh, hey, listen. Temperatures like 100 degrees. Like I got chains in me. Black male in the family of three. Been proud of my destiny. Reckon I'll fly away, cause it's too much for the man. Shouldn't have gone down this way. What happened to my master plan? Cause I can't figure out, I could have been a love child. Shouldn't have gone down this way. Tell me, how did I get lost?
Yeah.